Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest, and I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on What If, when we come back. Well, 3,300 years ago, Moses instructed our fathers. He said, "You shall not have in your bag diverse weights, a great and a small. You shall not have in your house diverse measures, a great and a small, but you shall have a perfect and a just weight. A perfect and a just measure shall you have." Well, our founding fathers at the Constitutional Convention in 1787 followed this scriptural principle of law when they put these 17 words into our Constitution. They say, "No state shall make anything but gold or silver coin a tender in payment of debts." It's in our Constitution now at Article 1, Section 10. But in 1933, President Roosevelt took our gold away, and in 1964, President Johnson took silver coin out of circulation, and in place of just weights and balances, these two presidents introduced our current practice of the first, the second, and the fifth planks of the Communist Manifesto into our monetary system. They gave us Federal Reserve notes in place of gold-backed treasury bills and clad coinage in place of silver coin. Now, in the intervening 70 years or so, we Americans have gone from being the world's number one creditor nation until today we're the world's number one debtor nation. Now, who do you think were the better financial planners for our country, Moses and our founding fathers, or Franklin D. Roosevelt and Lyndon Baines Johnson? Now, if you'd like to learn more about hard money and how to use it properly, it's another of the many lessons in my business school conducted twice a year here at the law school. If you'd like to learn more, why don't you order my free general law CD package first? That's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It's educational, it's informative, it's entertaining. And best of all, it's free. You can call right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Now, the business school is also available on compact disc for adult home study. If you're online, you can go to our website. It's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for that free general law CD package. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. What if? My old dad used to put that to me once in a while. He'd say, "Well, what if the dog hadn't stopped? He would have caught the rabbit. What if the people on the Titanic had bought a ticket on a different luxury liner? What if the captain of the Titanic had heeded the warnings that he received and steered south instead of north through the icebergs?" Everything in life is predicated upon what if. We use the term in our vocabulary, in our language. It's kind of a colloquial cliche. You know, well, what if thus and such, or what if so and so? We always apply what if to the past tense. It's always looking back and saying, well, what if we would have done this differently? What would the outcome have been? What if the quarterback had passed instead of run the ball? Or what if I had not married my first wife? How would my life have been different? It certainly changed after the divorce, Tom. So what if you hadn't married Agnes to start with? How would that have impacted upon your life? Well, in reading the International Forecaster this week, I noticed a whole bunch of what ifs. Listen to this one. General Motors' debt is close to the gross domestic product of Belgium. General Motors lost $10 billion last year and is now facing bankruptcy. Bankruptcy is inevitable, and it will be the biggest thing to hit the market in terms of losses and operational stress. General Motors has $300 billion of long-term debt, and $100 billion of that is in bonds, and they've lost 50%. 50% of the value of General Motors bonds are now junk. Others in the highly leveraged derivatives market face incalculable losses should a bankruptcy occur. And we can promise you bankruptcy is inevitable, and even many professionals know. But irrespective of this, it will hit world markets like a bomb. The reality, General Motors stock and debt is held by the biggest investment banks in the world, never mind small retail investors. GMAC, known as General Motors Acceptance Corporation, their credit subsidiary, presently is in about 65% of collateralized debt obligations. They're called CDOs, and it underlies about $1 trillion in default swaps. Parts supplier Delphi is bankrupt, and they are negotiating with the United Auto Workers and General Motors over wage and benefit issues. Delphi wants to cut hourly wages by more than a third. They want to cut wages from $27 to $16 by the end of the year. Now, the employees have been offered a $50,000 cash payment to remain at the company at the lower wage scale. Delphi proposes a permanent cut in wages to $22 from $27 an hour immediately, then to $16.50 an hour in 2007. It would start new workers at $10 an hour, and the $10 per hour offer would destroy the wage base for the future and then spread all over the country. If the workers do not accept and they go on strike, General Motors will be out of business by June. You can kiss GM goodbye. And this is just another phase of the deliberate destruction of the United States economy. There's a little bit more on General Motors in this week's paper, this week's newsletter. Let me flip over here to page 17. There was a couple of three little articles over here. Tell us over here that General Motors, adding to an already long list of problems, General Motors disclosed that it has been subpoenaed by the Securities and Exchange Commission seeking information concerning their precious metals transactions. What do you think that's all about? And then on page 18, there's another little piece here that says General Motors, which is closing plants in the United States, and says it will spend $650 million to build a car plant in San Luis Potosi. Now let's hear it again for free trade and globalization. All right, on the one hand, General Motors, their stock is going down. Their bonds have lost 50%. Their parts supplier, Delphi, is in bankruptcy. General Motors is on the verge of bankruptcy, and they're building a new auto plant in another foreign country for $650 million. And General Motors is going to stiff their creditors for about $300 billion. Well, they're not going to stiff them for the whole $300 billion, but they'll stiff them for a bunch. What's going on here? What's happening? Another little story that came out in the same newsletter. Remember this now as the International Forecaster, published by Bob Jetman. A fellow by the name of Louis, let me see if I can pronounce his name, Uchitele, Uchitelle, wrote a book published by KNOPF, K-N-O-P-F, KNOPF, 2595, 304 pages. It's a new book. It's called The Disposition, or The Disposable, rather, The Disposable American: Layoffs and Their Consequences. And it's by a New York Times reporter. His name is Louis Uccitelli, and he tells what happens to workers, blue and white collar alike, after they're laid off and no longer counted by the Bureau of Labor Statistics, and the stories taken together paint a picture of Americans unable to fully recover from the toll of downsizing, offshoring, and outsourcing, and its effect on productivity and dignity. This is the untold story of despair of those cast aside by the elitists who control our country and shove free trade and globalization down our throats while they get richer and more powerful, and we might add more arrogant. He challenges conventional business reporting, political rhetoric, and Wall Street wisdom that says layoffs are the best way to cut costs, and that a constantly shifting workforce is the law of the land, and that caring about workers is antithetical to good business. Layoffs are nothing more than admission of corporate failure or an excuse to employ foreign slave labor. And he fairly lays out globalization that has made the American version of job security an economic liability, allowing the system that took nearly a century to create to be undone and destroyed in about 20 years. This is recognition of globalization's costs, and this is about declining hegemony and its debilitating results. Corporations are bent on using only the cheapest workers, which again proves the productivity miracle is a sham. American workers and professionals face a very bleak future, given the fact that their skill level would not save them from a corporation that embraced layoffs as the ultimate solution for profit and shareholder value. Layoffs, as we have often said, damage companies by undermining the productivity of those workers who survive, but feel very vulnerable, as well as the productivity of those who are laid off and then got jobs again somewhere else. The negativism permeates the entire workforce's attitude, and it undermines our social structure, which is being done deliberately. In this book, we see a straightforward, matter-of-fact, and sincerely saddening elegy to the American worker and the decline of our culture and civilization. What we have built is being deliberately destroyed. Now there's a third part to the story here. Let me see if I can find it here, which deals with Detroit, and then we'll take a look at what if. As I flip my pages here, before the year is over, Detroit, Michigan will go into bankruptcy, and within a year after that, the state of Michigan will collapse financially. My advice is to get out of any Michigan-denominated paper now. Throughout the state, there will be massive layoffs by city, county, and state entities. And if you own property there, sell it now while you can. In time, the same will happen in Illinois, Ohio, Indiana, and upstate New York. Detroit will look like a third-world country with major crime, unemployment, and homelessness. Now that doesn't sound very good, and I ask the question, well, what if General Motors files for bankruptcy? Most people that I talk to say that won't happen because the government won't let it happen because General Motors is too big to fail. And I thought about Enron. They were the seventh largest country or company in the country, and for some reason, they weren't too big to fail. Now, General Motors used to be the biggest corporation, I think, in the world. They were certainly the biggest here in the United States. I think they've been replaced. They might be second or third now. Walmart, I think, is a little bigger, and maybe Microsoft is a little bigger. And remember, General Motors has been losing size. It's been losing market share now for many years. But they're about, you know, second, third, or fourth, or something on that order in size, and it could well be that the government may come in and prop them up. I don't know. It kind of depends. But let's ask the question, if the government comes in and props them up, if that were to happen, Well, where do you think the money is going to come from for that bailout? You know, oftentimes people say, well, the government wouldn't let this happen, or the government will do that, or the government will do this, or the government will do that. And I can't help but wonder what has happened in America over the past 50 years when people refer to the government like big sugar daddy. The government's going to do all these good things for us. So I thought I'd ask the question, where do you think the government gets all this money that they distribute all over? For instance, down in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, those people down there are looking for somebody to give them a hand. And so they don't want to rely upon themselves. It's not their fault that the government, that hurricane came through and that the government now is offering to come down and help them. President Bush wasn't pressured to go down there and help him. He went down voluntarily. He's been down there 5 or 6 times. And every time he goes down, he says, you know, whatever it costs, whatever it takes, we don't care. We'll rebuild it. He started off with $50 billion, raised it to $100, $200, $300. They're up to $500 billion. And the last time I heard somebody talking about New Orleans and Hurricane Katrina over the long haul, adding in all of the, you know, the little things, you know, that add up, like the interest on the debt. I mean, you know, you're going to borrow $500 billion to rebuild over the next 30 years. Anybody ever thought about how much interest are you going to pay over 30 years on $500 billion of borrowed money today? So, you know, if you borrow money in 2005 and 6, and you're going to pay that money back over the next 30 years at 5% interest, do you know how much that is? Well, 5% interest doubles the principal in 14.7 years. 14.7 years. So if we borrow $500 billion today, and we go down and spend that money and we rebuild the Gulf Coast, and then we pay that back at a very modest 5% interest over the next 30 years, it's going to cost $1.5 trillion when you add the interest in. Did you ever think about that? I know the average truck driver or housewife doesn't think very much about the interest costs or the long-term what-ifs that go along here, but let's start thinking about, well, what if? You know, what if instead of borrowing that money, what if we just paid it right out of current account? Somebody says, well, we don't have that much money. Well, if we don't have that much money, then why should we spend it? Well, you got all those people down there on the Gulf Coast, and they're hurting, and they need help. Why don't those people down on the Gulf Coast borrow it? Why should the people in Seattle, Washington, rebuild the houses for people in Biloxi, Mississippi? Well, we're told it's the American way, but who was building those people's houses down in Corpus Christi, Texas in 1900? It wasn't the people of Seattle in 1900, and there were hurricanes then, you know. Well, we're kinder and gentler today than we used to be back in 1900. Well, that's probably true. We're kinder and gentler. But again, what obligation do I have to rebuild the Gulf Coast? Well, because those people down on the Gulf Coast pay taxes. And after all, since they pay taxes, they have a right to expect their government to come in there and rebuild their houses. And again, I got to ask the question, why? What made those people down on the Gulf Coast so special that we should go down there and rebuild their houses? Well, because if a tornado knocks your house down, George, why then those people on the Gulf Coast and up in Seattle and Chicago and Portland, Maine are going to come down and rebuild your house. So what we're saying in effect then is that we practice from each according to his ability and to each according to his need. We practice that communist principle of share and share alike, from each according to his ability. We all pay our money into a common pot. Therefore, we can all draw it out. That's called democracy. Now, every place that democracy has been tried in the past, it's always failed, and so they're constantly selling us more and more democracy. Now, this made me wonder, what if we didn't have democracy? I mean, what would we have as a replacement for democracy? Well, you know, when we organized our country back in 1787, believe it or not, boys and girls, we didn't have a democracy. We had a republic. And I can't help but say, well, what if, instead of converting to a democracy, we had retained our republic? How would that have impacted upon our lives today in 2006? What would be different today under a republican form of government as opposed to this democratic form of government? You ever stop and think about that? What would be different? Would our lives be better? Would our lives be worse? You see, we didn't do it that way, so we don't know, do we? But in times past, when we had our republic, and we had a debilitating event such as this come up, the government didn't get involved in rebuilding. The government didn't have a burden to go tax the people in Seattle for the benefit of the people in New Orleans. The government didn't get involved at all. And the people had to do it themselves. But, of course, under our republican form of government, we didn't have an income tax. And that just kind of special. So without an income tax, then those people would have that money themselves, wouldn't they? And those people would be responsible for making decisions. The other day, I happened to be reading a magazine, I don't know if it was Time, I guess, or Newsweek, or it could have been U.S. News, one of the big three weekly news magazines, and there's a barrier island down in Florida. And on this barrier island is a condominium, and this condominium must be about 6, 8, maybe even 10 stories high, being built by some corporation on a barrier island. I thought, that seems kind of peculiar. When a hurricane comes through here, you know, sometimes these barrier islands are just removed from the face of the earth. And it would seem like to me that before I would want to build a condominium on a barrier island, I might want to ask, what are the odds that a hurricane is going to come through here at some point in time, remove this island and destroy this piece of property? Well, the contracting company doesn't really care, as long as the hurricane doesn't occur while they're building it, because they're going to sell these condominiums to people. And then I got to thinking, well, who would buy a condominium in a condo on a barrier island? It's a decision that everybody has to make. And the guy who buys the condo says to himself, well, of course I'll buy a condo here, because if a hurricane comes through here and destroys it, what do I care? The people of Seattle, Washington, and Portland, Maine will loan me the money to rebuild it. And probably I won't have to pay all of the money back, maybe not even any of the money back. It'll just come out of taxes, and the government will take the loss. Again, boys and girls, who is this sugar daddy called the government? Isn't that you and me? Isn't it some coercive power taking money out of my pocket and your pocket and sending it down to New Orleans? Now, I'm not opposed to charity. I just kind of like to pick out the charity that I want to give to. And that's not one of my favorite charities. It's not one of my favorite charities because I contend that those people knew or should have known that this is a hurricane-prone area. Now, boys and girls, I live in Tornado Alley. Tornado Alley. I don't have any insurance. I don't buy tornado insurance because I practice strict liability. So far, a tornado has not struck my house. And I think it's because in Deuteronomy chapter 28, in the first 14 verses, God said, now you practice my law, and I'm going to give you these benefits. He says, you'll be blessed in the city, and you'll be blessed in the field. A tornado coming through my living room is not a blessing. And a hurricane coming through Biloxi is not a blessing. But the conditions precedent to the benefit is that you practice my law. So I just took it to heart and I did that. I don't think a tornado is going to come through my living room. But if it does, and it could, I might not practice the law just the way God wants me to, and he may send a tornado and tear my house down. And if he does, I'll have to build another one. So I've made provisions for that. I've saved some money, and in fact, I actually bought another house. I bought a house trailer, and I set it up at another location so that in case a tornado comes through my living room, I'll have a place to move to. I mean, I just thought that maybe it would be a little prudent. I want you to notice something here. I'm preparing to take care of myself without going to the government and without going to you taxpayers in Seattle, Washington, and asking you to rebuild my house. I have chosen voluntarily to locate in Tornado Alley. There's a risk here, and I know what that risk is. That's why I'm the proud owner of two houses instead of one, because if I were living outside of Tornado Alley and I wasn't concerned about a tornado coming through my living room, I would only have one house. So I bought this old trailer. Now, it's not one of these $300,000 luxury homes in Southern California, in Malibu someplace. I'm just telling you, I bought this old trailer and I fixed it up in another location, and it's livable, and I wouldn't be too proud to live in it, especially if I didn't have another house to live in. So I'm taking care of the Gordons. I'm looking into the future. I'm saying to myself, what if a tornado comes through my living room? What should I do in advance before this event transpires? It's a little different perspective than waiting until the tornado blows my house down. I don't have any place to move, and I'm flat-ass broke, and I say, oh my God, what if? What if I didn't live in Tornado Alley? What if I hadn't bought my condominium on a barrier island? What if I didn't buy General Motors stock? What if I didn't live in Detroit, and what if I moved out of Michigan? Now, you remember the story of the Titanic? The Titanic, remember, was the unsinkable ship built by the low bidder, Harland and Wolff, in England. Actually, it's up in Northern Ireland where they built the ship, but it's under English dominion or English domination, however you Irishmen want to word it. Anyway, they built this ship. It was a technological marvel, and you've probably seen the movie and maybe even read the book, and the ship was unsinkable. And the question arises, what if the captain had heeded the warnings that he received prior to the sinking? If you remember, he had the new wireless. They called that radio. You know, today they call it radio. In those days they called it wireless, or the Marconi. They had another name for it. The guy that invented radio or discovered it was a fellow by the name of Marconi. And so they called it the Marconi. Well, anyway, he's getting all these warnings from other ships and from land stations that are telling him that there's all these icebergs dead ahead. And the captain takes the wireless message, you know, and he sticks it in his pocket. He's got five of these messages in his pocket. And this guy hasn't been, you know, just hired last week, you know, from the Department of Employment. This guy is a seasoned veteran sailor with 39 years experience on the high seas. He's been a captain for a number of years. He's in charge of the biggest ship in the world at that moment in time. You know, he's no dummy. Now, surely his experience must have told him that every ship that runs into an iceberg sinks. He's got five messages in his coat pocket that say, straight ahead, there's all these icebergs. And for some reason, he didn't steer south. He didn't slow down. Now, you know, you might consider the red light straight ahead, you know. And you say to yourself, well, I think I'll go ahead and run the red light. Should I run the red light at the speed limit, double the speed limit, or half the speed limit? I mean, if you're going to take this kind of risk, and you're going to sail your ship straight through all the icebergs, if you're going to take your car and you're going to run it through the intersection against the red light, would it be more prudent for you to slow down? Instead of going through at the speed limit 35, maybe you should go through at about 17 miles an hour. Or would that leave you in the intersection longer? And therefore, you say, well, gee, I think I'll go through at 70 miles an hour because it'll lessen my exposure. But if you have an accident, it'll probably increase the damages. You know, this is one of those what-ifs. Well, as you know, the captain of the Titanic decided to go ahead at full power. I mean, they said, light off another boiler and let's see if we can pick up another couple of miles an hour as we charge through the icebergs. They didn't consult the passengers. I mean, if I had been riding on the Titanic, and if I had those five messages in my pocket, and the captain came to me and said, well, what do you think, George? Should we double our speed, cut it in half, steer south, or go back? You know, I would say, well, do anything, but don't go through those icebergs. I don't know much about history of, I don't know much about sailing, and I don't know much about ships, but I do know that the history is ships that hit icebergs sank, and yeah, but this ship is unsinkable. So we have watertight doors. And if we hit an iceberg, you know, we won't sink. And that's why we only have half as many lifeboats on board, because we're unsinkable, you see. You know, these are all valid arguments, and the captain followed those arguments. He must have been sitting there saying, well, there's a certain risk. Chances are we won't hit an iceberg, but in the event that we do, we're unsinkable. As evidenced by the fact that the company here only put half as many lifeboats on here as we would need if we did sink. So therefore, they didn't think the ship was going to sink. We've got the architect on board. You know, he's riding on the ship. He thinks it's unsinkable. So let's charge through. Now, we all know what happened. If those people could be resurrected, you know, the day after they took that final plunge to the bottom of the ocean, if those people could have been resurrected, all those people that died on their way down, you know, to the bottom of the ocean, all those people who drowned or froze to death in the ocean, if they could have been resurrected the next day, taken back to England, and offered tickets on the Titanic, I dare say, I think I could be a prophet here. I'll bet you that not a single one of those persons, those people, would buy a ticket on the Titanic. And that's because experience is the best teacher that money can buy. I mean, you can't get any better than experience. And my old daddy told me one time, he said, you know, son, experience is the best teacher that money can buy. It's just that it's a god-awful hard way to learn. And he advised me. He gave me good advice. He said, son, before you do something, especially before you do something silly, ask me first. Because there probably isn't anything, and certainly not very many things, that you can think of to do that I haven't already done. Ask me and I'll tell you how it came out for me, and that'll probably be about the way it's going to come out for you. Now, I noticed that since 1912, all the ships sailing in the ocean have enough lifeboats for everybody now. And the technology surely is a lot better today than it was in 1912, but I don't think anybody's buying into the argument that the ship is unsinkable. And if I went down to the Carnival cruise and they told me, you should take a Carnival ship because they're unsinkable, I wouldn't ride with people like that. People that believe things like our ships are unsinkable, our airplanes don't crash, aren't the kind of people that I want to ride with. Because I always think about, what if? Well, hang on, boys and girls. Let me give you a friendly reminder, and we'll be back with more on what if when we return. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, please go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives, and it can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications used on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that those authors or publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. And that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone, and they do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Talking about what if. My dad used to have an old colloquial cliche: if the dog hadn't stopped to take a dump, he would have caught the rabbit. Ah, what if? We use it in our language. What if the people on the Titanic had paid attention to conventional wisdom? I'm talking about the management, the captain, the senior management on the ship. What if they had listened? What if they had thought in terms of history? Ships that hit icebergs sink. This ship is probably not unsinkable, as it proved to be. And nobody today, in his right mind, to my knowledge, says that ships are unsinkable, even ships with many compartments in them. Like aircraft carriers during World War II, there was two or three of them that sank. Several of the Japanese aircraft carriers, they were too big to sink, but they all sank. And Enron sank. Enron, the seventh largest company in the world, if not in the world, then in the United States, as I recall, went belly up. I don't know what their stock is selling for today, but it's not much. They're too big to let go under. The government wouldn't allow it. Can the government prevent it? In the 1930s, government didn't seem to be big enough to prevent the Great Depression. Governments don't seem to be big enough to stop World War I or World War II or Vietnam or Iraq. Events transpire whether we like it or not. Life goes on whether we like it or not. But it impacts upon us. You know, if the Titanic hadn't sank, the history of the world would be different today than it is. If the Archduke of Austria had not been shot and killed in Serbia, the world and its history would be vastly different today than it is. And if Adolf Hitler had never been born, the history of the world would be different today than it is. So you can't say that people, places, and things don't count. But of course, there's always that what if. I was talking to a student the other day whose daddy owns a lot of stock. And I asked the student, I said, "Does your daddy subscribe to any newsletters?" And he said, "No, he doesn't." Now, the son does, and he subscribes to the Privateer and probably the International Forecaster, which is what I'm reading from right now, asking the question, what if? Now, a lot of you listeners live in Michigan. Some of you live in Detroit. Some of you hold General Motors stock. And at some point in the future, you're going to come to grips with what if. What if I had sold my home in Detroit or in Michigan and moved to another state? What if I had sold my General Motors stock before they filed for bankruptcy? Would I have made more money or would I have made less money? Would I come out better or worse if I sold before the bankruptcy or after the bankruptcy? Other people might say, what makes you think General Motors is going to be bankrupt or go bankrupt? I don't believe General Motors is in any kind of financial problem whatsoever. I guess if you were riding on the Titanic and I walked into the A-class or the A-deck lounge and I said, my God, in 5 hours this ship is going to hit an iceberg and sink in 2 hours and 20 minutes, I'm sure that you'd look at me and say, well, I think you're mad. I think you're out of your mind. This is the safest ship in the world. This ship has watertight doors. This ship is unsinkable. You could flood any two compartments in this ship, and then it could sail right on to New York. Yeah, but you can't flood three compartments, or four or five compartments, and that's what happened. And nobody could foresee that when this ship hit an iceberg, that they wouldn't hit it head on, that they were going to scrape it, tear a hole in the side of the ship, flood five of those compartments, and the ship was going to sink. It was an event that nobody thought of. But what if somebody had thought of that? What if someone had foreseen that danger? And that's the difference between prophecy, foresight, and victimization, which is hindsight. Now, you know, hindsight's about 10-10, foresight's 20-20. Not very many people have very good foresight. They don't look ahead and say, gee, what if? I'm kind of an exception, I guess. I live in Tornado Alley, so I say, what if a tornado comes through my living room? I'm going to be homeless. Most people, I think, say to themselves, that's okay, because the people in Seattle are going to come to my rescue because they, like I, are practicing communists. But George Gordon's not a practicing communist, and I don't expect the people of Seattle to come rebuild my house for me. I don't think you people in Seattle owe me a house. I don't think you people up in Portland, Maine owe me anything. Conversely, I don't believe that I owe you anything. And if your house gets knocked down, I might send you $100. I might even come up there and help you rebuild it. I might do a lot of things, but I'd kind of like it to be voluntary. And I'd kind of like for you people to use some foresight. And I'd like you people to use some what if. Now, I'm not opposed to people building condominiums on barrier islands in the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of Pensacola, Florida. I think if you people want to build your condominiums on a barrier island, you certainly have a right to do that in the same way that I have a right to build my house right in the middle of Tornado Alley. But conversely, I don't think that you people up in Seattle should come down here and compensate me for making a bad decision when I build my house here in Tornado Alley, and a tornado comes along and knocks it down. That was my decision to make. And that's what life is all about. It's about making decisions. making good decisions. Building a house in a city 20 feet below sea level does not strike me as being a good decision. And of course, there's this old problem that we have of following the herd. Sheep do that. When one sheep goes through a hole in the fence, every other sheep in the flock wants to go through that very same hole. It's just the way they are. It may not be a good idea to go through that hole, but it doesn't make any difference to the other 99 sheep in the flock. If one goes through it, there's one that sees him go through it, he's going to go through it, that's two. Pretty soon there's four, then there's got to be eight, the hole gets bigger. They're all going through it, you're not going to stop them. So what you do is you let them all go through the hole, and then you go around, open up the gate, and round them up, put them back in. I mean, you're not going to stop them because they just go kind of crazy. And I was watching a program the other day, and they were talking about houses in Napa, California. Napa, N-A-P-A, California. And this couple bought this house up there on this adjustable rate mortgage. We call them ARMs. You don't pay anything on the mortgage. You just pay the interest. And it has a lower interest rate than a conventional mortgage. And so this guy is working, and his wife is working, and between the two of them, they make $109,000 a year. You know, they're kind of upscale, upper-middle-class people. And the guy that was interviewing them said, now, what happens if real estate starts down, or if it doesn't grow by 10% a year? These people are buying because they expected real estate to go up. You know, every year it's been going up 10-15% every year, and they expect it to go up 10 or 15%, and that's why they're very excited about getting into this new house with this adjustable rate mortgage. It's an investment that they want to make, and they're making pretty good money. Now, I'm a businessman. I've been around the business world for a long time, and as a businessman, an old man, I'm an old businessman. You know, there's an old adage that says there are old pilots and there are bold pilots, but there are no old, bold pilots. Well, as a businessman, you know, I've had pretty good success in the business world. And there are old businessmen and there are bold businessmen, but there aren't any old, bold businessmen. The old, bold businessmen are the guys that were buying Studebaker and Hudson when they should have been buying something like Microsoft. And so I read newsletters, and when I get a newsletter like the International Forecaster, and by the way, here at the Law Hour, when we get a report, we corroborate that report with two or three others. There's an old biblical proverb that says, it's an old statute, in fact, it's more just a proverb, it's a statute. It says, at the mouth of two witnesses, or at the mouth of three witnesses, shall the matter be established. If I just read this from Bob Chapman, I would take it and say, well, maybe that's true, maybe it isn't. But when I pick up the privateer and he tells me the same thing, and then I pick up the money changer and he tells me the same thing, and then I pick up Kitco and they tell me the same thing. By the time I read that four or five times, I say, gee, I'm surprised that Bob Schieffer isn't reporting on the imminent bankruptcy of General Motors. Do you ever wonder about that? Why isn't it that ABC and CBS and CNN and MSNBC Money Watch is not reporting to you about this imminent collapse of the economy of Michigan? You know, there are people out there that can tell you what's going on. You can rest assured that the governor of Michigan knows what the financial condition of the state is. You can rest assured that Standard & Poor's and Moody's knows what the financial condition of Michigan is in, and General Motors and Ford, Microsoft, and they report on that. These are public documents. It isn't that you couldn't know this. It's just that you're driving truck for Walmart, and you know, maybe you've got some Walmart stock, and maybe you've got some, or a 401k, and maybe you're invested in some stock operation over here, and you believe that the people who are managing your money in this stock portfolio are doing a good job for you, and no doubt they have some Ford and General Motors stock. along with some other shares. And you have confidence in them. You hope that they're going to manage your money. And I sit here and I say, you know, what if you managed your own money? What if you were educated? Now, that's a wild new concept. What if you were educated? And you could pick up these financial reports and look at this and say, General Motors. Now, I'm not any great investor. I don't invest in General Motors. I invest in my own projects. I have never given my money to somebody else. Well, not in several years. I used to in the old days. But, you know, in the past 30 years, I don't give my money to somebody else to invest. I tested that. I gave my money one time to a friend of mine. He's a good buddy, and he lost it all, and he never paid me back. And I learned a lesson from that. If you give your money to your friends and they lose it, they won't pay you back. I couldn't learn that from my dad because I never asked my dad in advance. He probably could have told me had I asked him, but I didn't ask. So I went out and reinvented the wheel. And I've observed this over the last 50 years as a businessman. And I can tell you, if you lend your money to your friends, they won't pay you back and they will lose it every time. I don't know of any exceptions to that. And so I've observed that. And I've also made some other observations. When I find that two or three witnesses tell me that an event is likely, you can almost bet that the event's going to transpire. Now take that condominium down there on the Barrier Islands. I mean, he's not the only guy building it. They were telling the story about this one big one. This is a big condominium. It's a big building. There's a lot of littler, smaller buildings on the same island. And I could almost predict that at some point in time, I don't know when, but at some point in time, just by time and chance, just by the throw of the dice, a hurricane's going to come across that island at some point in time. And what do you think's going to happen to those condominiums and homes that are on that Barrier Island? And here's my point. Those people are making conscious decisions to move to that island. It's not that they're being forced to. It's not that they don't have any other choices in life. They're paying top dollar to get on that island. They're paying a lot of money and going out of their way to get into harm's way. Let me ask you this, boys and girls. Do you believe that there might be another hurricane in the 2006 season that will strike the United States of America? Last year, I think we had four or five. Every year, there's two or three or four or five. I can't remember. You know, I'm an old man now, and I can't remember any years where some hurricanes, multiple hurricanes, did not strike the United States somewhere. Do you think that a hurricane is going to strike Fargo, North Dakota? Are you concerned about a hurricane in Helena, Montana? I don't think you people up there in Fargo and Helena need to be too concerned about hurricane insurance. Maybe, you know, depending on where you're located, you might want to consider some flood insurance. But I live at 1,200 feet. I'm up on top of a mountain ridge. And I don't have any flood insurance, and I have no intentions of buying any. None. And I don't have any tornado insurance, and I'm gambling, just like everybody else here that lives in Tornado Alley. I'm gambling that the God of Heaven is going to steer those tornadoes around me because I follow those instructions in Deuteronomy 28 and Leviticus 26. I could get real surprised. I don't deny that. But even if I get real surprised, it's going to be because I was breaking the law. And if I break the law, then there's no guarantee that that tornado isn't going to knock down my house. And I find it hard to believe that the people in Portland, Maine, and Seattle, Washington, owe me a new house because I couldn't obey God and keep His commandments. And that's kind of where I'm at with New Orleans. Now, I'm not opposed to you people down in New Orleans building your houses 20 feet below sea level. I'm not opposed to that. It's a choice that you people need to make. Now, you built your houses 20 feet below sea level. A hurricane came, and flooded your house out. Now, that kind of tells you a story right there. Are you really sure that you ought to rebuild your house 20 feet below sea level? Now, it would seem like to me that if the Titanic wasn't unsinkable, that there isn't any reason for us to believe that subsequent ships being built are unsinkable. And it would seem like to me that if one hurricane can come in and flood your house 20 feet below sea level, that a second hurricane could come and flood your house 20 feet below sea level. And I just really don't think I ought to rebuild your house for you over and over and over and over again because of your bad decisions, any more than I believe that you people out there on the West Coast should build me a new house because I choose to live in Tornado Alley. Now, there was an old principle of law that we used to follow here in America, and that was called individual responsibility. It's a wild concept, individual responsibility. That is, if you want to hitch up your wagon and your horses to your wagon and go out to Oregon or Washington and migrate and take advantage of the wide open spaces, that's your business in life. But don't expect us to subsidize you. So the people that went west in the covered wagons had to pay their own freight, had to buy their own ticket. Some of them didn't make it. Some of them got killed along the way. It was a choice that they made. And for some of them, it was a good choice. And for some of them, it was a bad choice. But the government didn't come in and subsidize the bad choices. And I'm sure that the Donner people are sitting there saying, what if we'd have stayed home? Well, they would have all lived and died of old age somewhere back in the East. And they wouldn't have been cannibalizing one another, and they wouldn't have been branded with that Donner cannibal story if they hadn't done it. But that was a choice that they made. And they made the choice, and history now contains the Donner story. History today contains the Titanic story, and history tomorrow is going to contain the General Motors story. What if? And I contend that if we applied what if to the future, instead of applying what if to the past, we could probably avoid a whole lot more trouble than we're going to get into and then expect somebody out in Seattle or Portland, Maine or Miami to get us out of. Because you people down on the Gulf Coast aren't getting out of your trouble very easily, and your government and FEMA isn't doing a very good job for you. I think that if you had relied upon individual initiative instead of from each according to his ability and to each according to his need, you people would all be money ahead. And if you don't rebuild on the Gulf Coast, I think you're all going to be money ahead in the future. But again, that's your choice. What if? All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide over the Internet. For more information about The Law School and The Law Hour, please go to our website. And remember, that's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience. And the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.